Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Obscura is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Because Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help when you need it. So, your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations.
Listener, released with this episode is going to be a free fireside chat. And I'm going to release one next episode as well. Just to give you guys a taste of what you're missing on the Patreon that just isn't Black Label, because there's other stuff that gets released there too. If you'd like to hear more, head to patreon.com/obscurecrimepodcast. If not, just enjoy the episodes and the fireside chat.
For a time in the late 90s and early 2000s, a man stalked the streets of Jacksonville, Florida. He stealthily dispatched of women in a manner of which he got his nickname, the Jacksonville Strangler. Today, we cover this man and his many crimes, but like with many episodes of Obscura, we're going to start from the beginning.
Welcome, listener. I'm glad you're here. Take a seat next to the fire.
Welcome to Obscura, where we shine a light on the dark.
DeRusso was born on August 10, 1970, in Beaumont, Texas, to unwed parents. His mother was battered by his father when she was pregnant with him. DeRusso was severely jaundiced at birth and was held 3 extra days at the hospital because of this condition. It is written in his medical records that he experienced brain trauma in utero. DeRusso and his older brother, Joseph III, moved to Los Angeles to be raised by their mother and her family. As a toddler, DeRusso was in a baby stroller which tipped backwards, causing him to strike the back of his head. Although he did not lose consciousness, he sustained a balloon-like swelling at the back of his head. He was rushed to the hospital, and his mother was advised to monitor him for several months. A doctor who later examined DeRusso explained that the brain which sits inside the skull could have been jarred forward within the skull from the fall, causing injury to the front part of the brain where the frontal lobes are located. She compared it to injuries sustained by infants in shaken baby syndrome cases. As a child, DeRusso was diagnosed with a thyroid disease. The disease ran in the family, and according to at least one doctor, it's something that could have contributed to his brain damage. The disease is also something found frequently in those diagnosed with bipolar disorder, though they're not mutually exclusive. Bipolar is a disorder that DeRusso would later struggle with in life. DeRusso cried a lot as a young child. His mother said he would fool around and was difficult to manage, took many risks, talked in class, and sometimes talked and talked without being able to shut up. He was described as having grandiose ideas about his own persona, and he considered himself irresistible to women. June Orr, a close family friend of his mother, described him as humorous, a nice child, always willing to help and lend a hand to others. Family friends on LaTanya Street and Kiana Michelle Williams Medina testified he was also respectful, courteous, and polite. Dolores Sheen, the principal at Sheenway Educational and Cultural Center, where DeRusso attended school from 1985 to 1987, testified that she never once had to discipline him. Although records show he was not a good student, he participated in all school activities and attended school there the regular 5 days per week. John Sims, a close friend of Paul's brother, Dennis Page, said DeRusso shied away from physical contact because he was afraid of getting hurt. Because of this fear, he did not participate in sports other than running track. According to Mr. Sims, he was kind of shy and meek, but he was always positive. The Russo's cousin, Eric Moten, who was raised with him and his brothers, described him as always together and the one who was the easiest going of us all. He further stated, "I never saw him do anything out of line." Mrs. Medina described DeRusso this way, quote, "Paul made every effort to keep things balanced. I mean, that was one thing that, as a young man and as a man, he was very even-keeled. He wanted things to be smooth sailing, easygoing. He was very laid back. You know, if things were in a despair mode, that all you could see was despair, he had a joke for you. Paul experienced some racial discrimination from his peers back then. Some of the white kids didn't want to play with him because he's black." DeRusso was sexually active from the age of 12. Several previous girlfriends were interviewed and stated that sometimes he wanted sex constantly, but then, randomly, he'd become disinterested and distant. During these periods, DeRusso would lay in bed for the majority of the day and only speak when spoken to, giving short answers before rolling over and withdrawing. Paul DeRusso was experiencing depression and pervasive paranoia. Sometimes he was seen talking to himself, and when people asked him who he was speaking to, he would just smirk and say, "No one." Paul DeRusso grew to an imposing 6'6" tall. He was thin with muscles, all sharp features like he was carved from obsidian. His facial features seemed exaggerated, with a near permanent grin, and he had a bulging Adam's apple that was difficult to miss. Paul had an IQ of only 82, which put him at the borderline of an intellectual disability. He had limitations in learning, such as being barely literate, which explains the special education curriculum that he completed in high school. Despite this, he was surprisingly astute when it came to electronics. Early on, he took a liking to technology, and he was always helping people repair things. And so, that is to say, the extent of his brain damage is hard to gauge. Paul had sexual relationships with 20 different women between 1999 and 2002. Now, listener, usually such activities require a certain degree of charm, not often associated with individuals who have very severe brain damage. I'm not saying that he didn't struggle in school, but I'm also saying that moderately low IQ shouldn't be a defense cure-all. In 1989, Paul became a security guard after graduating from Reseda High School in Los Angeles. In 1991, he was arrested for carrying a concealed weapon. He received 3 years probation. 1 month later, he was arrested again in California on the same exact charge. In November 1992, Paul enlisted in the Army rather than marrying a woman that he got pregnant. In 1992, in Oklahoma, where during basic training in the Army, Paul DeRusso was involved in an outdoor exercise in freezing temperatures. There, he refused to sleep inside of his sleeping bag, choosing instead to sleep outside the bag. Despite the bitter cold, Paul failed to give an explanation for this behavior. It's around this time that he started hearing voices, at least according to Paul. He was in basic training at the beginning of his military career. He remained in the Army for about 5 more years. He received a bad conduct discharge. He did not receive a medical or mental health discharge. We'll get into why he was discharged a bit later. Paul was later stationed in Germany in 1995. Paul married Nautica Spann, a soldier that he met in Germany. In 1996, at the age of 26, he re-enlisted in the Army and was stationed in Fort Benning, Georgia, 1 month later, a woman was kidnapped and raped in a neighboring city. 2 months later, Paul DeRusso was arrested and charged with kidnapping and rape. He was acquitted of the charges in a court-martial due to unsubstantiated evidence.
And checking his arrest record, we see that he would, he's like he lived a charmed life. Yes, he'd get arrested, but the charges would either be dropped or he would plead or get convicted of a lesser charge. He just kept going. And to me, and when you get a person like this that thinks he can get away without having to answer for his crimes, then to me, they become very dangerous and they're going to escalate.
He later pleaded guilty in a separate case to receiving stolen property, leading the Army to dismiss 2 larceny charges against him, in particular for buying computer equipment stolen from the military base. DeRusso subsequently received a bad conduct discharge. On September 7, 1997, the nude body of 26-year-old Tracy Habersham was discovered by a person walking their dog in Columbus, Georgia. It was the neighborhood where she had grown up. Tracy went missing after dancing with DeRusso at a nightclub. Her body was found 2 days later, and investigators believe she was strangled soon after leaving the club. Investigators noted to the local papers that the murder was particularly brutal. Tracy had fought hard. Several nails on her fingers were broken, meaning she'd attempted to fight off her attacker. She wasn't going to go down easy. Someone out there was walking around with scratch marks covering their arms and potentially their face. Tracy died with her eyes open. They bulged in an accusatory stare, asking the universe a question she didn't live to receive the answer to. After his discharge from the Army, DeRusso and his wife relocated to Jacksonville. In September of 1997, Paul's wife, Nautica, gave birth to their second daughter. 2 months later, due to continued domestic violence, Nautica takes her 2 daughters and moves to Jacksonville, Florida. DeRusso follows them to Florida. In April 1999, Paul was arrested for molesting a 15-year-old girl in Jacksonville, Florida. Charges were not filed. 1 month later, he was arrested in Jacksonville for trespassing and spent 2 days in jail.
We had found in his criminal history that DeRusso had been arrested in 2001 for sexual battery on a 19-year-old female here in Jacksonville.
Tamika Thomas was walking to work. She said that Paul DeRusso pulled up next to her. He asked her if she was single. She said that when she got off of work, he was there. He gave her a ride home. And she described him as being handsome and charming. Tamika Thomas said that she and Paul DeRusso engaged in consensual sexual activity on numerous occasions. She said that she caught him with a passion mark on his neck and broke off the relationship. After she broke up with Paul DeRusso, he flipped out. He grabbed her by the neck, slammed her against her dryer, picked her up, carried her upstairs, ripped off her clothing, and sexually battered her. She said he also said that if he couldn't have her, nobody would.
In 1999, a woman named Teresa Mack lived in an apartment in Jacksonville with her 3 small children. On July 26, Max's children were picked up by the daycare around 7:30 in the morning. Adam Moss, a friend of the family who did handyman work for them, arrived at the apartment to fix a lock for Mac. Adam noted how clean the apartment was. The TV played in the background while he worked on the lock. Nicole Jackson also came by Max's apartment that morning. She and Mac left the apartment to look for work together. Adam Moss also left prior to Mac and Jackson leaving. Mac was wearing a black and white outfit when she went out with Jackson and an X and O necklace with a heart pendant and a matching bracelet. Jackson and Mac submitted job applications, ate at McDonald's, and continued looking for jobs. They then returned to Mac's apartment around 1 p.m. It was very hot, very humid. Jackson's car had no working air conditioning, and Mac was shiny with sweat and appeared tired. Jackson dropped off Mac, who went into her apartment, and Jackson left. Around 1 p.m., Mac spoke with her friend, Tezalyn McFadden, on the phone about getting a ride to a doctor's appointment for Mac's son. At 1:25 p.m., McFadden called Mac back and asked her to call later in case she fell asleep. Joy Williams was a neighbor of Teresa Mac and knew her. Around 1 p.m. to 2 p.m. that afternoon, Williams saw a tall, skinny, dark-skinned man with a noticeable Adam's apple, walk out of Mac's building, carrying a television toward a red four-door car. Rufus Pinckney was also at the scene at the time. Mr. Pinckney also knew Teresa Mack and was waiting for a bus sometime after 1 p.m. that day. Pinckney saw a tall, light-skinned, skinny black man wearing a blue work outfit. Pinckney saw the man with the large Adam's apple get something out of the trunk of a red car and then walked upstairs to Teresa Mack's apartment. Listener, the red vehicle previously mentioned was a red Mazda RX-6. Paul had purchased the vehicle earlier that year. He worked at Goodyear at the time, where he wore a navy blue work uniform, noted by the witnesses. Teresa Mack did not call Tezalyn McFadden back, as they had agreed. So McFadden attempted to call Mack at 2:50, but Mack did not answer. She tried to contact Mack several more times, but never got an answer. At some point, Sharabia Mack, Teresa Mack's sister, became worried because all of Teresa's children came home from daycare, even though Teresa was supposed to have taken one of them to the doctor. Sharabia went to Teresa's apartment. It was a hot day, and insects buzzed in the air. Despite knocking several times, no one answered the door. Later, Sharabia returned to her sister's apartment with Lamar Odom, her stepfather. They still received no answer, so they broke in. While Teresa's bedroom had been neat when Sharabia visited 2 days earlier, it was now, quote, a disaster. The bedroom had been ransacked, with a chest of drawers pulled out and an empty purse. Teresa was dead, lying on the bed, wearing a shirt but no bottom, with a white telephone cord wrapped around her neck. Sharabia recognized Teresa's shirt as the one she wore for the interview at McDonald's. Teresa's underwear were found underneath her and torn. The cord had a jack at one end, but appeared to have been torn at the other end. The cord appeared to match Teresa's phone, which had the cord missing, torn off the base. There was dust on the entertainment center, but no dust where the television had been. Sharabia also noticed that Teresa was not wearing an X and O's heart pendant necklace that she wore every day, and a matching bracelet. Teresa had a green phone in her living room, but the cord was missing. The cord had a jack at one end, but appeared to have been torn from the other end. The cord around Mac's neck appeared to match Teresa's phone. It appeared that it was torn off the base of the phone. Dr. Margaret Aruza conducted the autopsy on Teresa Mack. Mack was 5'4" and weighed 122 pounds. She had abrasions on her nose, cheek, and tongue. The abrasions were on both sides, indicating that she was moving her head back and forth and had marks on her arms consistent with being restrained. While there was a cord around her neck, Dr. Aruza could not determine whether the cord contributed to the death. She opined that Mack died of asphyxia. The asphyxia could have been caused by strangulation or suffocation. Dr. Aruza also found sperm in Mack's vagina. From March through June of 1999, Paul DeRusso's children, as well as Teresa Mack's children, attended Tina's Little Angels daycare. In August 1999, Paul's wife, Nautica, asked police how to get a domestic violence restraining order against him. She wouldn't be granted that restraining order until 1 year later, when he was arrested for brutally assaulting her.
Asked Sharabia if her sister had any known enemies or she knew of anyone that might want to bring harm to her.
So it's like, who could have did this? She don't even let strangers in her house. So it had to be somebody she kind of knew and we just didn't know. You know, it was very difficult. Particular day she was supposed to get them from school because the baby had an appointment. Well, at 5, they brought them to my grandmother's house, which wasn't normal for that day because she was supposed to pick them up.
Teresa's grandmother had tried to contact Teresa multiple times that afternoon by telephone to no avail. As a result, she contacted Sharabia by phone and asked her if she knew where her sister was. Sharabia had no idea but immediately headed over to the apartment. We identified two witnesses during the investigation. One of them observed the suspect exit the apartment building with the TV in his hand. Both of the witnesses observed the suspect enter a vehicle and leave the area. We learned about four individuals that knew the victim around the time of her death. We conducted thorough interviews with each one of these individuals, during which time we also obtained consensual DNA from them. Ultimately, none of these individuals matched the description provided by the two witnesses. The DNA database was composed of known profiles. Our suspect was not in the database. As a result, you're left with a profile and you're trying to find a match. It's almost like a needle in a haystack. Unless you find that particular suspect that matches, investigation continues.
Listener, that's it for part one. In the next episode, we get to the rest of the murders. It only gets darker from here. The Jacksonville Strangler is one that doesn't get covered often, and I'm not fully sure why. He's just not one of those big hitters. It occurred to me randomly, might as well give it a shot. Anyway, if you'd like to hear part two, you can head to patreon.com/obscuracrimepodcast and get access to it now. But if you're a patron, well, you likely already have access to it. Anyway, I thank you for listening, and keep the fire burning. Listener, did you know there's an online cannabis company that ships federally legal THC right to your door? And they found a way to combine THC with carefully selected functional ingredients to target nearly every mood and health concern that you can think of. I'm talking about Mood.com's incredible line of functional gummies. Forget one-size-fits-all supplements that only get you high. Mood's functional gummies are optimized to kick in as little as 15 minutes and take you to the mood you're looking for. Whether that's mind magic gummies for deep work and creativity, PMS support to ease cramps and balance mood swings, or their sexual euphoria gummies to help you feel ready for action and turn every touch into a full-body experience. Listen, you can find gummies to just get you high pretty much anywhere these days, but Mood's functional gummies combine premium, federally legal THC with targeted botanicals to help you get to the perfect mood. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, listeners get 20% off their first order with code Obscura. Head to Mood.com. Find your functional gummy that matches exactly what you're looking for and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. And don't forget to use promo code Obscura when you check out to save 20% off your first order. Listener, we've all had headaches when dealing with financials. Overdraft fees, missed payments, or wishing you had ways to save more. Chime understands that every dollar counts. Chime is banking done right. Open a checking account with no monthly fees and no maintenance fees. Get paid up to 2 days early when you set up direct deposit. With qualifying direct deposits, you're eligible for free overdraft, up to $200 on debit card purchases and cash withdrawals. To date, Chime has spotted members over $30 billion. You heard that right. Open a checking account with no monthly fees and no maintenance fees. Not to mention, access to over 47,000 fee-free ATMs, more than the top three national banks combined. My younger self would have benefited from this. I'll tell you that. Work on your financial goals through Chime today. Open an account in 2 minutes at chime.com/obscura. That's chime.com/obscura. Chime feels like progress.
Chime is a financial technology company, not a bank. Banking services and debit card provided by the Bancorp Bank N.A. or Stride Bank N.A. Members FDIC. Spot me eligibility requirements and overdraft limits apply. Timing depends on submission of payment file. Fees apply at out-of-network ATMs. Bank ranking and number of ATMs according to U.S. News & World Report 2023. Chime checking account required.
Listener, how are you? Tonight, I'm in a contemplative mood. My wife is visiting her sister, and she took the baby with her. Weekends like this give me an opportunity to put in a lot of work into the podcast. And so, I've been chipping away at Black Label. Now, what I want to talk about today, or tonight, is death. Now, you would think with a true crime podcast, this subject would come up more frequently, but when you think about it, we sort of take the subject for granted. It's the natural conclusion to many of the people we hear about in our episodes, be it the victims or the killers. We all have death waiting for us, and how we choose to deal with that varies person to person. Growing up, I was a stone-cold atheist, and these days, I'm a Christian. It's not something I talk about a lot, especially on the podcast. I know what it's like to deal with judgy people, and I never would want you guys to think I'm that way. In fact, when I worked for Blockbuster, back then I was an atheist, and when my coworkers found out, it got around, and I was basically fired for it. But to make a long matter short, I had a spiritual experience, and it's done a lot to alleviate my fears of death as I've gotten older. And so, yeah, that's nice. I feel very blessed having that stress taken away from me. I'm pretty tranquil when it comes to thinking about the subject, but it wasn't always that way. In fact, I had quite the fear of death all the way into my adulthood. When I was young, as a kid, I would lay in bed thinking about it. I would think about what it was like to die, and then just the next thing, nothing. Not sleep, not even blackness. The absence of life, whatever that is. Exactly what happened before you were born. And that concept was both mind-blowing to me and terrifying. And I hope I'm not giving you anxiety, listener. I come to you in a sense of solidarity because we've all experienced these stresses and these thoughts. And so, yeah, that concept of eternal nothingness was on my mind a lot growing up. And then when I ended up in relationships and friendships, etc., it became the fear of those around me dying. And it overwhelmed my own fear of death. And so that was less at the forefront and more in the back. It would sometimes bubble up, but I became more worried about those around me. And in a way, I wanted to go first. I know that sounds crazy, but like before my friends, before my loved ones, I didn't want to experience them dying. And I thought I had the edge when it came to my siblings. But then my brother Cody died of drug overdose. Fentanyl-laced drugs took his life, and that hit me hard. I think that's one of the only time I've taken an extended break from the podcast, so that should tell you everything there. And do you want to know a cowardly moment? You see, my sister went to identify my brother, and she took pictures and maybe video of him. I'm not entirely sure. While he was laying there deceased. And when we were at Cody's celebration of life, she offered for me to see the pictures. And would you believe it? Big Mr. True Crime, Mr. Obscura, I declined. I didn't want to see my brother that way. That's not how I wanted to remember him. My brother was always a character. I'll just put it that way. People say things like, oh, They brightened up a room or whatever. No, he was more black sheep material, but he was very funny and he felt larger than life. When I say lit up the room, a lot of people were holding their breath, but I always loved him. And, to see him just, laying there dead, I didn't want that to be the last image I ever had of him. And I didn't want that in my brain. I knew enough from true crime that you can put images inside of your head that you can never take out, because there are many cases I've covered that boil their way up to the surface. And so, yeah, I knew better. But I also recognize it makes me a little bit of a hypocrite, right? A lot of the cases I cover, those loved ones never got the opportunity to not see their loved ones in that state. And then the people in my family, my friends, were also kind of safeguarded in the fact that I think all of us want to be cremated. I don't know about you guys, but it seems like burial services are falling out of popularity. And
open caskets seem like a thing of the distant past. Now, it could just be my immediate circle. I haven't looked up the statistics or anything like that. So I recognize I could be biased, but I could also see why things could go that way. I mean, we did it for a long time as a sense of tradition, but I have been to funerals in the past, and I've been to open casket funerals. It was never anyone that I had direct, you know, friendships with or anything like that. It was always distant relatives that I had met maybe once, if that. Some I had never even met before. The first time I met them was, well, with them laying there in that casket, all waxy and still. And so I knew from those experiences that those open casket events, everyone seems uncomfortable, everyone seems sad. And so if those are going away, I don't know. It doesn't seem like a lot will be lost. Maybe you guys will disagree with me. Maybe there's a lot of you here that prefer to adhere to tradition, and that's fine too. I mean, obviously, it's been a practice for so long for a reason. Obviously, some people find something attractive about it. Maybe it's the sense of finality, a closing chapter, so that you can process it and move on in a stronger way. Because I will say, during Cody's celebration of life, when I was staring up at those fireworks that we had purchased for him, it was unreal. It took a long time for me to accept that I had had my final conversation I'd ever had with him. I'd never be able to speak with him again. And yeah, death. Death and true crime go hand in hand. But like I said before, a lot of times we're onto the case. You know, we're onto the suspect, you know, whoever committed the act. The death happens, you get the gruesome details and maybe the autopsy report afterwards. But actually sitting there and contemplating death, the absence of life, that's not something you stick around and do a lot because it's uncomfortable, right? Considering your own mortality. And yeah, it's kind of interesting because I have spoken with people before, and there are people that are totally, you know, maybe atheist or agnostic, like, you know, I was for so long. And they're very comfortable with their own death. They look at it as, hey, when they die, they won't even know it happened. It'll just be passing into a sense of peace, connecting with, you know, the rest of eternity and returning from before they were born, right? And I guess there is something sort of beautiful to that, if not admittedly a little scary, let's be honest. It does seem unfair though, right? You know, going back to, you know, let's say you look at it from the, you know, atheist or agnostic standpoint, this idea that you're given this gift of life and, you know, obviously, not every day can be a gift, right? We all have our days, but let's just say gift of life. And we have all this potential and we work so hard. And when we finally start figuring things out, time starts to set in and time starts to move fast. And every day goes by faster than the last. And then every month a bit faster. And then every year. And you start looking around and you're like, wow, this isn't slowing down. I'm just now figuring things out, and it seems like the end is getting nearer. And so, yeah, I don't know. Maybe this is on my mind subconsciously because my birthday just happened. I'm on the deep end of, you know, 30. I'm 37 now, pushing towards 40. And so there's something to that. You know, like I did say, I'm pretty tranquil when it comes to that. I mostly care that my loved ones aren't stressed about it. I look at my daughter and I see that she's so young. She has so much ahead of her in life. And it just fills me with joy. I just want to make, you know, her childhood happy. And so I think it's easy for me too, as well, beyond any religious aspect, to dedicate myself to focusing on her life. I'm not that worried about myself when it comes to that. Even stresses with the podcast, worrying about financial aspects and keeping listenership up, checking Patreon and hoping that too many people don't unsubscribe, you know, stuff like that. Now it's related to my daughter. I'm not that worried about myself, like I said. If it was just me, the older I got, the less I worried. I'd be like, well, I can always do construction or whatever. But now I think about, man, you know, I'd like to make her life special. And so it kind of drives me to work harder and, you know, get those episodes out and get to typing, get to researching, etc. And so I think when you look at someone so young like that, it can be hard to have death on the mind. So my birthday passed, you know, came and went this year, and it was sort of the least eventful birthday in a while. My wife had time off from work, and we went to the mall and did some early Christmas shopping. And then we watched some movies at home, and we just spent time as a family. We had a few ideas of big to-dos we could have done. But to be honest, in Florida, there was a cold front. We woke up one morning, and it was 30 degrees, which is very uncommon for Florida in the first half of November, for sure. A lot of times, we don't see that type of weather until, like, January, right? And only a couple days a year. So to get it so early was a big surprise. And so I remember we had even had thoughts of potentially swimming, because it's not uncommon to have some November days out here in Florida, you know, that are in the 80s. And so, yeah, it was cold. And so we called all that off, and, you know, we just had some lazy family days, and it was a good time. And if I had plenty of more days like that, I would be happy. You know, just time spent with the family. I don't need that much eventfulness in my life going forward. I'm happy to work on the podcast, you know, spend time with my family, see Cody get older, get her into, you know, whatever, programs, sports, etc. Be supportive of her, watch her get older. And hey, you know, if I'm lucky enough to live that long, and if she makes that decision as well, maybe I'll see some grandbabies one day, you know? Maybe that's not out of the question. And so, yeah, it's easy to kind of be invested in life right now, for me, at least. But I do know that death waits around the corner for everyone. And so we had a death, not in my direct family, in my wife's direct family. And so part of the reason why she's at her sister's is she is making an appearance at a celebration of life. An older figure, but not too old, still kind of tragically young, in his 60s, very beloved man. He died. He was found in his yard. And it was a big surprise. And so I think that's the other reason why this is on my mind. Because by all accounts, you know, previous to that, he had been walking around just fine. And then one day, death just came and took him. And just like that, the family won't be having too many more memories with him. And that's very sad. Because like I said, he was very beloved. And so, yeah, I can see why this is something I'm thinking about with that as well. But what about you, listener? Do you still think about death a lot? Particularly if, let's say you're an older listener. When you're younger, I feel like it's very common, right? You're still coming to terms with it. But I'm curious, you know, I don't know if you want to leave a comment or whatever. Is death something you think about a lot? When you lay in bed at night, when you close your eyes, do you think about eternity? Do you think about death? Do you think about what comes after? Are you secure in your feelings of what comes after? Be it atheist or religious? Do you feel a sense of peace when you think about it? This is something that I'm curious about, but it's not something you can exactly ask people at random. When you sit down with your friend for a casual conversation, it's not always the easiest to just be like, hey,
What do you think about when you die? Like, what do you think happens? Like, do you think about dying a lot? Just imagine just casually bringing that up to your friends. That's a few beers deep talk. And so it's not always the easiest to broach that subject. And so I genuinely would love to hear from you guys as far as that's concerned. And then I was thinking about it as well. You think about it like, sometimes you watch movies where death occurs and it can be handled so casually, sort of brushed over a lot. There might be like a montage or something. Of course, you do get the movies that kind of heavily lean into it. But for the most part, movies, you know, if there's like a death mid-movie, a lot of times it'll be for like the shock, you know, and then you're on to the next scene. And so one of the things I do try to do with Obscura, I did that Lunsford case, Jessica Lunsford, and I do try to add gravity to the victims. I don't always accomplish that. Sometimes details can be sparse and limited, or sometimes an episode can just take you in a different direction. But, you know, using the Jessica Lunsford episodes as an example, when I can, you know, I do like to, you know, add some gravity to the situation. I do like to lean into it. I think it's healthy, you know, as consumers of true crime, to remind ourselves from time to time that there are consequences to these cases. It's not just a whodunit. It's not just a mystery. And I know I talked about that in the episode, because sometimes that's something that can drive me crazy, be it the iTunes reviews or the occasional email I get. People will write me a lot and say, why do you do spoilers at the start of your episodes so often? You know, and look, sometimes episodes will be structured in a way where you find out who is doing this stuff later. It really just depends on how it presents itself. But for the most part, that is not something that I'm worried about. The sort of mystery aspect of true crime, that's not really what Obscura is or ever has been. A lot of the times, the episodes will start with the biographical, you know, profile of who the killer is. So as the episode goes on, you have a better understanding of why they might be doing what they're doing, or if you ever can fully explain that. But, you know, you might just have a little bit better of an idea. And so I would much rather jump into the childhood and the psychological backgrounds, etc., and build the episodes that way. To me, it's almost a little strange to lean heavily into these sort of cliffhangers. I just don't think narrative-wise that's something I particularly enjoy. You know, it's no secret. I do enjoy, for example, Stephen King, right? And it's been a minute since I've read one of his books, but he was one of the guys that got me through some dark times when I was a kid. And I'll always defend his work. I know people have their criticisms of his work, and that's fair. You know, you don't have to like everything. But what I did want to say is that he's one of those authors that plays with structure a lot. Sometimes he will rob the reader of that sort of, you know, build to what's going to happen. Like, a character will walk out of a scene and then Stephen King will end the chapter by saying, and then they never saw him again. And so you're like, oh, wow, okay, so he's about to die. But also, what that does to you, at first you're like, whoa, that means, you know, he's going to die. But then when you read on, you have this like sense of overwhelming dread of like, okay, so how's he going to go? Or, you know, like, in what way is this character going to die? Or, you know, how does it all go down? And so when you see it from that approach, you understand that not everything has to be accomplished the same way. And sometimes when you approach a narrative differently, it gives you a different feeling. So, for example, in the Lunsford, in the Lunsford episode, you knew who it was going to be the whole time. And what I think about when I'm making that episode is it gives you a sort of sour feeling in the pit of your stomach because you know what it's building to. You know what's going to happen. You know that people are going to be hurt in this monster's wake. And so as the episode presses on and this person gets bolder and more dangerous, you sort of sigh in frustration at the way the system sort of failed the family members in terms of stopping this guy. All the, you know, freebies he was given. And so, yeah, speaking of death, I did want to mention, my feelings on the death penalty continue to evolve. And I'm sure some people have kind of noticed. And let me explain. It's a pretty balanced take, I think. And if you don't want to hear this type of talk, you know, if you don't want me to have a firm stance on anything, you can go ahead and turn it off now. But I wanted to say that where I am emotionally when it comes to the death penalty, I've always been hung up on, personally, the fact that they can get it wrong, right? So for me, if there's ever even an ounce of doubt, I think that the death penalty should be withheld because there has been a surprising number of people that have been executed and then exonerated post-mortem. And so when you think about that, it's pretty terrifying, right? Like blood on the taxpayer's hands and blood on the government's hands, killing innocent people. But this is where my opinions on this has sort of evolved. When I was younger, I was pretty staunchly overall anti-death penalty. But I have come to a place now where I think that if somebody is dead to rights, like they did it, they, you know, without a doubt, they did this murder. Maybe they confessed, or maybe there's just absolutely overwhelming evidence. A good example is, so let's say mass shooters. Some jerk, you know, puts a bunch of guns into a duffel bag. They go to the local elementary school and they just open fire, right? And they hurt and kill a lot of people and all the families connected. In my opinion, I don't think that we should sweat it. I think that mass shooters should be an instant death penalty. We just shouldn't even waste the trial time or anything. They, like, you know, they did it. We all know they did it. It was out in the open. Everyone saw them do it. I'm not worried about it, right? Like, I'm not going to waste, you know, feeling any certain of way towards someone that hurts so many people. And so I guess that's where sometimes my feelings on this stuff has evolved, because, you know, when I was younger, I was completely, totally against it. And if you are, that's fair too, right? We all have our own opinions on this stuff. And these discussions are nuanced. So don't think that I'm judging you for that. And I ask for you to do the same thing for me. And so, yeah, I promise I'm not trying to be a fence sitter on this. Like I said, my only hang up is when there's an ounce of doubt, because there are cases where there are, and they didn't get them dead to rights. And a lot of the evidence is purely circumstantial. And in those cases, I don't know how you can defend the death penalty. But again, dead to rights stuff, I'm not worried about it. Like, I just can't possibly care. When I see, like, I'll cover an episode, for example, and there'll be some brutal child abusing murderer, right? That really hurt some kids. And there are people protesting, you know, for this person. That, to me, it's like, man, your time is better served elsewhere, I promise you. There are a lot more people out there that deserve it than that monster. And so, yeah, I don't know. My opinions on this kind of stuff, always evolving. I think it's kind of important, though. I think in some ways, the older you get, you should look back on your previous stance and be like, wow, I'm a bit of a different person. I know for me, when I get Facebook memories and they're like 10 years old or something, there are a lot of cringe deletes. I'll just put it that way, where I'm like, what was I thinking? and I'll just, you know, click delete on it. And so, yeah, who knows how I'll feel 5 years from now from it, but I don't know. Right now, I'm a bit 50-50 on it, given the circumstances being different. But what do you think, listener? That's another thing. If you wanted to comment on that, if you have a strong opinion on it, there'll be no judgment from me. I'd be happy to hear what you think. And so, yeah, this has been a fireside chat that's sort of loosely based around death. I hope it hasn't bummed you out. For me personally, it's an interesting subject. It always has been. I'm probably going to leave some of the vocal stumbles I did in the episode, try to clear out any coughs I did or anything like that, because I'd like to get back to, you know, working on episodes while I still have the rest of the night. But I don't know. If you're interested in more of these open subject fireside chats that are kind of late night rambles, let me know, because I'm not opposed to doing these. It's good to get some thoughts, you know, off my chest and kind of throw them out into the universe. If you guys like hearing it, I don't mind publishing it. Anyway, I think that wraps things up. I thank you for listening, and keep the fire burning.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.